This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Man versus nature, or humankind versus nature, if you prefer. A theme that continues to draw moviegoers to the box office. From sweeping views of barren peaks in the IMAX epic Everest to Tom Hanks' solo survival story, Castaway. And documentaries like Before the Flood, narrated by Leonardo DiCaprio. And our Planet series with David Attenborough tells stories about climate change and about our own role in shaping the Earth's biodiversity. On this edition of Movies on the Radio, film experts Marsha Gordon and Laura Boies cover your picks for films about nature and the environment. And they will, of course, share some of their own. Marsha is a film professor at North Carolina State University, Laura, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art, and curator of the Movie Diva series. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks so much, Frank.
Thank you.
This was fun because nature and the environment can be anything in the whole wide world. And a lot of films come to mind. And our listeners, and I love our listeners. May I take
I
this moment
too.
To say that?
Yeah.
Because they always pick things I never would have thought of.
Me too.
They're spot on when they tell you why. But talk about the breadth and the range that we sort of had to choose from.
Well, I think this is a topic that, interestingly enough, really transcends genres, right? If you think about documentaries, if you think about dramas, if you think about sci-fi, if you think about films for kids, even if you think about comedies, there are a lot of films that use nature in different ways. And, you know, when I was thinking about this as a topic, to my mind, these films fall into kind of two categories, which maybe you nodded at the beginning of the show, which is the observational kind of educational films that are about the kind of curiosity, wonderment, and maybe admiration for the natural world. And then there are the kind of human beings exploiting and destroying the natural world, which, you know, and never the twain shall meet.
But yet we are asked to look at beautiful ocean views of tropical fish and then dead coral reefs. And is one happening or is the other happening? Well, they're both happening. And somehow you have to synthesize that in your imagination.
Yeah. And I think that also in that category is there's a very strong and long tradition of trying to motivate audiences to care about nature. It's kind of exhausting when I think about how many years people have been trying to urge people on this planet to be good stewards for the planet because we all have to live in it. And yet it seems that we still have to make that argument over
since,
and over
since
again.
The first Earth Day in, what was it, 1970?
Yes.
Well, that brings me to my point in all of this that I observed in looking at the choices and hadn't really thought about. But our relationship, our estrangement from nature is a theme one way or another. But when we talk about climate change today, we've already given up the possibility that we could ever be part of nature again. What's interesting is back at Earth Day, you know, back in the 60s through the 70s, the estrangement from nature became an issue. And could there be a resolution and could we ever come back to the garden was kind of, you know, an issue. It seems to be off the table now. It's a subtle but profound shift. And I think one that is reflected in our first choice today.
My name is Jennifer Landon, and I'm from Cary, North Carolina. My pick is Deliverance. And the reason I picked this movie is because it was unexpected for me to see the symbolism of nature and its power and how man struggles against nature. And it also has this wide understanding expanse of nature in that you see it as beautiful and peaceful and life-giving, but then you also have to be respectful of its power and its violence and cruelty.
Lewis! Lewis! I'll tell you what. We'll wait until dark and we'll put you in the bottom of the canoe and you sneak out of here. Okay,
yeah. Bobby, look at those rapids down there. Oh. Look at those rapids.
Christ.
You can't move out of here in the dark. We're not going to move you, Lewis.
Lewis, we're trapped in this gorge.
Lewis!
Ed!
What are we going to do, Lewis? You're the guy with the answer. What the hell are we going to do now?
Now you get to play the game.
There we go. Jennifer with her pick, the 1972 classic Deliverance. Marsha Gordon and Laura Boys with us on The State of Things.
Well, people have very differing attitudes about going out in nature. And for me, the fear is always there because I grew up in a very manicured suburban environment. And, oh, let's take a hike. I'm going to trip and fall and break my kneecap. I mean, so it's very hard for me to enjoy the peace and the beauty because I see the menace lurking around every corner.
Well, and so many films use that, right? I mean, if you think about how many films, terrible things happen in deserts, forests, the woods.
Wild rivers.
Right, wild rivers. I mean, that idea of we seem to have this desire and reverence for spending time in nature. We have national parks. We have a kind of a camping culture. And yet, you just can't control nature. And that's a great movie plot.
No, and we've always tried it. But of course, the original sin was the knowledge of good and evil, right? And the difference between good and evil, that's the separation, right? That's the moment in which we say, we'll take it from here, nature, and want to see nature as beautiful, pretty, and peaceful. And part of the film was, it ain't. Let's get back to the completeness of nature, which is violent and rough and brutal and also pretty. And then if we can put Humpty back together again in our minds, we could actually appreciate nature. But, you know, you might end up squealing like a pig and then the whole thing would
fall apart. But there's also the issues of masculinity and how, you know, man, specifically the male gender against nature and conquering and all of that. It's so a part of the American psyche.
Well, let's move to our next one, which is, again, back in that era where if we didn't watch our step and reconcile with nature, this might happen.
Hi, my name is Sherry Emanuel and I live in Raleigh. And my pick for an environmental or nature movie is Soylent Green. It's an old movie. I saw it a really long time ago. It's a futuristic dystopian sci-fi thriller. And it shows what is going to happen on this earth. And it actually, the movie actually takes place in 2022, which is pretty scary. The earth is completely polluted. There are no natural resources left. There's no food to eat. And everybody is eating something called Soylent Green, which is made by this company called Soylent Industries. And this movie just made my hair stand up. And I realized then this is where we're heading if we don't do something about trying to fix the environment and hope it's not too late.
This is the police. This is the police. This is the police. The supply of Soylent Green has been exhausted. You must evacuate the area. The scoops are on their way. I repeat, the scoops are on their way.
And they are scooped up and brought into the machine. This, by the way, is why I do not eat kale chips.
I have a theory about kale chips?
Since I've seen that movie, I just won't touch them. You never know.
Well, I love this pick. I mean, I think the dystopian sci-fi films that imagine the catastrophes of the future, and of course this film came out in 1973, so it was forward-looking and we are now inhabiting that future. But, I mean, I think the caller is absolutely right. This is the world that we are on the verge of living in. I'm sure people have read the headlines about all this meat that's, you know, being grown in laboratories now because we are going to have to figure out a way to feed people without being able to have the amount of agriculture and the taxing on the environment that it has. But it is a kind of demented notion, and it puts the control of our food supply in the hand of corporations even more than it is
Corporations are people, my friend.
That's right. Right. What is the difference?
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
well, the most moving thing to me in this film is Edward G. Robinson, one of the characters. You have an option for euthanasia, and you get 20 minutes of a beautiful montage of how the earth used to look. And it's especially moving because Edward G. Robinson himself was dying of cancer at the time. This was the last scene he ever filmed. He was basically reenacting his death that would happen only 2 weeks later. But as time has gone on, I felt more and more that this actually is going to be our option, that we're going to choose euthanasia and one last beautiful movie before we go.
Well, this is Homo Deus, right? This is speciation, where we go from Homo sapiens to Homo Deus. We no longer have the option of reconciling with nature. We've taken control to the point that we now need to fix it, and it probably means some degree of euthanasia and offing some of the people on the planet now that we've chosen to wreck the balance in the way that we have.
Well,
we're not putting Humpty together again.
This is a post-Earth Day movie, and a lot of these are where people really felt that there was a moment where we could change, which of course has passed.
And there's so much activity on this subject matter in the 1970s. I mean, when I think about the periods of time where films were really trying to take on the environment, the 70s is definitely the hotbed.
And Charlton Heston, not known for his progressive politics, but interesting in this moment where this was where liberals and conservatives came together, which was on the environment.
Nixon started the EPA.
Nixon started the EPA.
We do all have to breathe the same air and drink the same water, more or less.
Marcia Gordon, film professor at NC State. Laura Boys, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art, curator of the Movie Divas series. Movies on the Radio continues with films about the environment and nature. On the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. Movies on the Radio today, Marcia Gordon, Laura Boys, and your picks for nature and environment films. We actually heard from some environmental experts with their favorite picks, and here's one of them.
My name is Eleanor Spicer Rice, and I am an entomologist from Raleigh. And one of my all-time favorite nature movies is Harold and Maude. And the reason I love this movie as a nature movie is because its themes are rooted in the natural world, and it has influenced the way that I view the natural world. So the movie reminds us of how important we are when we pay attention to the world around us and appreciate things around it for its own sake. Now, there's one scene in the movie when Maude says that this guy, Alfred Dreyfus, was in prison on Devil's Island.
Dreyfus once wrote from Devil's Island that he would see the most glorious birds. Many years later in Brittany, he realized they had only been seagulls.
It's easy. You own me.
For me, they will always be glorious birds.
Well, if you want to sing out, sing out. And if you want to be free, be free.
And I always think about that when I look at all the animals in my yard, like the squirrels or the robins or all these creatures that we see every day, or even the seagulls. And the movie always reminds me of how glorious these parts of our world are when we take the time to notice them.
And it was entomologist Eleanor Spicer Rice who talked about the movie Harold and Maude.
I really like that observation. When I saw this on the list, I thought, what? But it really does, that the idea of nature permeates so many films in ways that are not obvious as well. And that's what I appreciate about this pick.
And a little bit about the reconciliation. It's like, this is what we lose when we don't connect ourselves to nature. And of course, Maude was somebody who you admired for her spirit.
And it's so much more subtle than, say, the other extreme, which would be the birds. Alfred Hitchcock taking that which is ordinary and turning it into something menacing.
And of course, we haven't even gotten to documentaries yet. We've only done feature films, but documentaries are sort of spot on. Let's listen to one of them now.
My name is Yvonne Huxtable. I'm calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. And the film that stood out for me was Before the Flood, that was produced by Leonardo DiCaprio. And the reason why the film stood out for me was, one, because it was surprising that a celebrity as big as Leonardo DiCaprio would make a movie like that and about that. And then just to see that everything that he brought out, to me, seemed real.
Islands in the Pacific. We're paradise in peril. Throughout Palau, we have sea level rise coming into the farmlands, coming into the homes.
This is unbelievable. When was this an intact island with homes on it? How long ago?
12 years ago, when you came, there were people living here. So within the 12-year period, this is the result. It's just a small picture of one place. The small island nations who contribute the least to the causes of climate change are actually going to feel the worst impacts, the worst scenarios because of global warming.
It made me feel really sad to see that government in particular knows about all of these things, but ignores them or chooses to ignore them or cover them up just because of money and because of greed.
That's Yvonne talking about Before the Flood, a 2016 documentary.
Well, a celebrity brings their fame to bear to try to raise awareness about issues. And in fact, last night I watched An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's movie, in which 10 years ago he basically predicted with some very clear and wonky graphs, you know, what is happening now. And one of the quotes that he had was from Upton Sinclair, who said, "Man won't understand something if his salary depends on his not understanding it." And so that we know what's happening. It's clear. There's a scientific consensus. It only takes the changing of the mind of the public to try to pressure the politicians to keep us from killing ourselves.
Right. And this is, I mean, what's so infuriating, I think, about the moment we're all in is that this is an argument that has been made, you know, really consistently since the late 1960s into the 1970s. And I, you know, that question of the government, well, you know, whose side are they on? I mean, if Al Gore had been president, the environment would have been his priority, right? And it's just a matter of making that a priority for whoever is in the biggest position of power to have that kind of influence.
Other documentaries center on the beauty and the grandeur of nature.
My name is Dave Naden. I'm from Durham. I think the nature film that most impresses me is the documentary Everest. It came out in 1998. It's about the climbing season in 1996.
The top of the world, where the wind is fiercest, is a desolate, deathly place where humans cannot live. Every breath burns the lungs like cold fire. Many have died there on the mountain known as Everest.
And Mount Everest is a very romantic, imaginative adventure. Very exciting. I think the thing that, you know, really made me think about this time around for Movies on the Radio is that all the news that's happened recently about the condition of the mountain.
Heading up the steep, icy Lhotse face that day, we watched a column of over 50 climbers, including my friend Rob Hall. They faced a three-day climb to reach the summit. At the time, even though I felt uneasy, I never suspected what a nightmare they were heading up into.
It's just very spectacular movie to see in IMAX.
The 1998 IMAX documentary Everest.
Well, the most recent kind of iteration of that was Free Solo from last year, which was about the rope-free climbing of El Capitan. And this does point to another fascination we have, which is that people who will risk their lives to have these experiences in nature that most of us would never, I mean, I barely breathed watching the film, would never think of doing something like that. But that idea of being out there and engaging with nature in unconventional ways.
Did it ring true for you, Laura, the climb? Because I know you've climbed Everest. And
you know, Frank, the narcissism of these climbers I find really disturbing. Yeah. Like in that movie, one of the climbers, his wife is pregnant and he dies on the mountain. And it's like, how dare you do that? And I really thought it was a great adventure, actually, until I read Into Thin Air by John Krakauer, which talks about, you know, the wealth
also made into a film.
The wealth of the people who are able to climb Everest. And I suppose it's a great accomplishment, but I would rather you take your money and your passion and put it into something that's more productive.
Well, this is where I get a little prickly.
I'm sorry, that's a little preachy.
But I do the same thing. This is where I'm prickly and grumpy for the same reason, because on the one hand, I am confronted with the absolute spectacular grandeur and the bigness of it, right? And that should overwhelm me and awe me. But the story is about conquering it. Is it about beating it and again, estrangement. you're the mountain, I'm the man, and I'm going to beat you. And then, yeah, everybody else has to really bend to my will and think I'm cool and working hard. So would you all mind supporting me and giving me everything I need to do it? I get a little bit, I feel that.
Well, that's an American tradition, right? That the adventurers, the male adventurers in particular, going out and conquering the wilderness and coming back alive if they're lucky.
So that conquest part can be the little
Absolutely.
Tricky part. Well, more documentaries and more ways in which we engage nature. Let's listen to this one.
Hello, my name is Will Boys.
Will Boys? Hold it, Boys. Do I recognize that surname? Who
Indeed,
is this?
That's my husband, Will Boys.
How did he get on the show?
Well,
does he know somebody?
He works at the U.S. EPA, and I thought that he should speak up for films on nature and the environment.
And he did, and quite well. So let's rack it up, and we'll play it from the top.
Hello, my name is Will Boys. I'm an environmental health scientist for the EPA. I'm calling from Durham, North Carolina. My choice for the environmental film is Chasing Ice, which is the story of James Balog and his team documenting the change in glacier formations in Greenland, Iceland, Alaska, and other places.
Adam, it's starting here.
Look at that. Look at the whole thing.
The glaciers are just very dynamic, and they're moving away from you at an incredible speed, and it's just so compelling.
The initial goal was to put out 25 cameras for 3 years, shoot every hour as long as it was daylight. That would show you how the landscape was changing.
Oh, this is the way to travel, my friend.
Putting really delicate electronics in the harshest conditions on the planet.
It's not the nicest environment for technology.
I do not want to go any lower than this. It's just bottomless.
I'm going out here on this broken fin, and I assume it won't collapse.
It's undeniable evidence of climate change. And the thing that made me, that infected me the most was that a lot of this film was made in The filming was done in 2008 and 2009, which is now a decade ago. And when you realize how little we've done on climate change in that decade and how policies are actually going in another direction, it's quite disturbing.
Chasing Ice, Will Boyes talking about that one.
Yes, and we also watched the pop disaster movie version of this, The Day After Tomorrow, in which the ocean currents stop. There's a new ice age, which Al Gore discusses in his movie, in fact. And then just to open the newspapers, 4 inches of hail fall in Guadalajara. It's exactly what happened
it's
in The Day After Tomorrow.
Yeah. And I mean, just as a moment of seriousness, thank you, scientists who are listening, for sticking it out, especially at the EPA. We need you right now. So you're doing important work.
Yeah. Reason and science in short supply in the highest levels. So to be able to talk about, but again, let's talk about the filmmaking part of this, because we've been talking a lot about the environment, science, our engagement with it as people. But now let's get back to the filmmaking business, because I want to talk about some of the themes. Bring them together. This film does that. You get to see this stuff melt. You get to see how much has happened in a short period of time, and then only imagine where it's going to go from there. But it's also framed as this adventure story. It's these guys out there, I think it's going to hold. Maybe I won't die. So there, in a way, and I'm not. It's not a deep criticism, but it suggests that one of the ways to sell these is to use some very familiar storytelling techniques that Hollywood has mined for a long time.
That's absolutely right. I mean, there is a long tradition of representing nature and tying it into a kind of adventure narrative. And if that's what you need to do in order to get distribution and to get the underwriting for a production, then so be it. But a lot of this has to do also with the history of technology and our ability to capture with kind of camera technology has evolved so tremendously. I mean, in the early 20th century, it was a big deal to be able to do micro cinematography and to show people things they couldn't see with the naked eye. And as cameras get smaller, more portable, more flexible, drones, things like that, we can see things that we couldn't have seen 50 or 75 years ago.
I'm James Krause. I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina. And my favorite animal nature film is the great film, Never Cry Wolf. It's a wonderful story about the wolf itself in its habitat And it's a sad story about how civilization and indeed money and business encroach on the wolf's habitat. It's well acted. It's beautiful cinematography. And it also has a great part played by the native Alaskans. All in all, it's a tremendous movie about several different areas of our current society, which, although it's an older movie, it relates perfectly well to today.
In the end, there were no simple answers. No heroes, no villains. Only silence. But it began the moment that I first saw the wolf. By the act of watching them with the eyes of a man, I had pointed the way for those who followed.
I don't know if it made any lasting impressions, but it certainly cemented the impressions I already had, which led me to do several things in life, one of which is served on a state commission on trying to stop the unnecessary slaughter of dogs and cats in this state.
James, on the 1983 Walt Disney film Never Cry Wolf.
Well, there is a romance of the lone naturalist, too, which began mm-hmm. for a lot of us reading about Jane Goodall in National Geographic. Certainly, Gorillas in the Mist, yep. and even to a certain extent, Grizzly Man. People who feel an affinity with these creatures and try to protect them through their knowledge of their lives.
I remember seeing this film as a pretty young kid and just being so moved by it. I haven't seen it since then, but it's kind of no wonder given, you know, the films that were coming out in the 80s, which were more kind of narrativizing some of the things. You know, Laura mentioned Gorillas in the Mist, which I also remember very strongly about Diane Fossey, that are, just create this incredible sense of empathy for animals in the wild, even if they have to do it through the device of, you know, the scientist or the explorer.
Hasn't the weather been strange? It could be a warning.
I've been having bad dreams.
Deep beneath the city lies a secret, guarded by primeval terrors beyond imagination. Is coming. Only one man can stop it. Your dreams will never be the same again.
That is a clip from the 1977 Australian mystery drama The Last Wave, and Laura Boy's pick today on The State of Things.
Yes, this is a very bizarre movie about climate change, kind of magical. It talks about links with nature, is also being with the Aboriginal people in Australia, and stars the most famous Aboriginal actor, David Gulpilil, as well as Richard Chamberlain. But it talks about dreams and premonitions, and that if you mistreat the earth will take its revenge.
And it starts with a hailstorm. I mean, starts in the first few minutes, a hailstorm that surprises Australia. They've never had a hailstorm that enters the classroom. And it made me think about that storm in Guadalajara this week or last week. You know, another film that did this really well more recently, I thought, was Mad Max Fury Road, which is about water scarcity and power.
Also Australian.
Also Australian. They have been thinking about this maybe more intensely than we have.
Well, we've been talking about your picks for films on nature and the environment on this edition of Movies on the Radio. Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State. Laura Boys is film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. We've got many, many more to come, but I want to tell you that Laura is going to be screening director Howard Hawks' film Ball of Fire at the Carolina Theater in Durham on Wednesday, July 10th. That's at 7 o'clock, and A League of Their Own at the same theater on July 11th at 7 o'clock. And tell us more about the director, Howard Hawks.
Well, what I would like to say, that I'm being political now and I'm going to say something completely different, which is that we're also having a special book signing and an introduction by Elizabeth Weitzman, who has just written a book about women in film and television. And she's actually coming to do special introductions and book signings to talk about Barbara Stanwyck, an actress as an auteur who really shaped her own film image in a very definite way, regardless of who was directing her. And then Gina Davis, who has been very involved in her Women in Film and Media organization.
All right, so that's on July 10th, both days, the 10th.
And the 11th.
And the 11th.
At 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock, Carolina Theater, Ball of Fire will be screened, and then A League of Their Own. And anyway, we've got all that information, but it's in July, and that's this month. And it's at our website, stateofthings.org. And we've got lots more movies just ahead on the State of Things, so do stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, and we are talking about your picks for films about nature and the environment on this edition of Movies on the Radio. My guests are film experts Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys. Marcia's a film professor at NC State. Laura's the film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art, also the curator of the Movie Diva series. And we've been talking about vast ice flows and sweeping mountain ranges. So let's zoom in now to the tiny, tiny world of the smallest elements in our ecosystem.
My name is Carol Ann McCormick, and I'm from Saxbahaw, North Carolina. I work at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill Herbarium, which is a museum of plants from the Devonian to today. And my pick for a nature movie is Microcosmos. It came out in the early 90s, I think, and the thing that I liked about it is that it has very little dialogue. Mostly it's noises of insects and small critters, and there's some music that's lovely. And my favorite part of the movie is when two snails are having a romantic moment and there's lovely opera music. I remember seeing it with my 3-year-old daughter, who was enchanted by it.
Is from the film Microcosmos, Carol Ann McCormick, curator of the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill Herbarium, who talked about that 1996 film. Available online. We'll link to the scene that she's talking about directly. We'll also link to you can see the
naughty snail scene.
It's gorgeous, isn't it?
It's so beautiful. I mean, this film, I remember when it came out just being completely blown away by the photography. And as someone who has historically not been a bug person, but who is evolving into a better relationship with bugs, I mean, this really, it's so beautiful to watch. I mean, insects cleaning themselves and feeding and actually seeing what happens on that level. And this is an example of that kind of subtype of like what the naked eye does not see, or what, even if you see it, you probably aren't looking at. And it's one of the kind of gifts that film can give us in relation to nature.
You don't have to climb to the top of Mount Everest to see something magnificent.
No, but you have to be on your belly and really looking and thinking a lot about finding these two snails. And I will say this, you talked about the magic of filmmaking and the artifice that it is, Marcia. And I think that's what's beautiful about it, is because actually, if I did see two snails doing what they do in nature, I would not have the same feeling about them. But where the empathy is created is in slowing it down and showing in a way that makes me empathize with what otherwise is just not pretty. And it was gorgeous, and it was beautiful, and it wasn't erotic. It was just beautiful.
Yeah, and you know, a film that did this more recently, I think in interesting ways, even though it was not without its flaws, was Biggest Little Farm, which was just in theaters, and it's a documentary about these farmers who try to take this arid land in Southern California and turn it into a beautiful biodynamic permacultural environment. And a lot of what's magical about that film is the photography of nature. And I mean, it's extraordinarily beautiful at its best.
My name is Emily Meineke. I'm a scientist at Duke. I study plants and insects and climate change. My favorite movie about the environment is Fern Gully. I grew up in the 1980s, and Fern Gully was one of the movies as a kid that I watched over and over and over again. And I think it's because I had a budding interest in the environment and in natural history, and the imagery is just so beautiful in that movie.
I'm Zach.
I'm Krista.
Nice to meet you.
You're going to love Fern Gully. It's the most beautiful, wonderful place in the forest. Well, come on. A baddie can carry you.
What? Not this little mammal. Fly a human. I'd rather suck wax fruit.
And in particular, I remember as a young person really liking the scene in the movie where the person gets shrunk and then they're hopping along the mushrooms up to the top of the trees, and the mushrooms are sort of lighting up. And it's a magical scene that really captivated me and made me even more interested in the environment.
And is Duke biologist Emily Meineke and her pick, Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest from 1992.
I'm really surprised that the animation movie that nobody mentioned was WALL-E, which is definitely, it's a dystopian cartoon, which is a little weird, about a little trash compacting robot obsessed with Barbara Streisand's Hello, Dolly.
Well, but who finds a living plant? That's
right.
the miracle of that film, and does everything he can to kind of protect it and
the
tend
last,
to it.
The last plant.
And I mean, the film that Emily's talking about, I have not seen it, but the it's so important, I think, that these films are made for young people about how people destroy environments and about how magical and beautiful they are, because that is often, I think, what makes people interested in studying and learning about those things. And so I'm glad that Fern Gully did that for Emily.
We need more of them.
We do.
Yeah, well, and getting back to WALL-E, I mean, I think that there again, you've got masterful storytelling that weaves together romantic relationships with our relationship with nature, what's been lost, the pain of kind of what's been lost, and a certain naivete. So I think there's a kind of genius in that storytelling. And when we do it well and can bring everything together, powerful stuff, and that movie is still around. We did get a tweet, by the way. Somebody tweeted WALL-E, so it's not like nobody thought of it. All right, let's move on. Marcia,
yes.
Tell us about your pick.
Okay, so one of the reasons I picked this is several people had nominated it, and then it did not end up picked, and I felt like we have to talk about this film. And it's Silent Running from 1972, directed by Douglas Trumbull, who did the visual effects for Kubrick's 2001. So this is an environmental sci-fi film, and it's very much of its time. I will say that in both ways that are good and maybe not so good. What I find interesting about it, and I just rewatched it again yesterday because it had been a little while, it is such a moving film to me, despite a lot of its kind of 70s baggage, including Bruce Dern, Bruce Dern is one of the great, not so great actors in many films, I would say, but he's perfect. He's perfect for this. But the premise of this is that the Earth is no longer viable for plant or animal life. We never see Earth, and it all takes place on this spaceship. And it's Bruce Dern, who's an astronaut, who's tending to these greenhouses in space in an attempt to preserve them to eventually refoliate the Earth. And he is on the ship with these three men who are kind of callous and juvenile, and they get the order to nuclear destruct the greenhouses, basically, with no explanation. And these other men are like, great, let's do it. Let's move on. Bruce Dern, not so much.
Hey, Lord, give me a slice of that cantaloupe, huh?
Hey, don't ask Lord for a slice. I'd be delighted to give you a slice of that cantaloupe.
Just sit down and shut up. Sit down, sit down, sit down! And shut up and leave me alone, all of you, now, and let me eat.
Hey, now, what's a big deal? I can't see the difference between that and this anyway.
You don't see the difference? The difference is that I grew it. That's what the difference is. That I picked it and I fixed it. and it has a taste, and it has some color, and it has a smell. And that it calls back a time when there were flowers all over the earth, and there were valleys, and there were plains of tall green grass that you could lie down in, that you could go to sleep in. And there were blue skies, and there was fresh air, and there were things growing all over the place, not just in some domed enclosures blasted some millions of miles out into space.
There we go, the 1972 sci-fi film Silent Running.
And it's also a moment of romanticism about space travel, that somehow people thought that if we ruined the Earth, we could go to some other planet. I don't yeah. exactly understand that.
Well, and like the scene you talked about with Edward G. Robinson in Soylent Green, it has this nostalgia for a past that not everybody remembers or everyone has experienced. And I also like the way this film makes conservation patriotic. I mean, his rebellion is against the corporations and the government who are telling everybody what to do at this point. And even though that's a subtle part of the plot, I think it's an important one to remember right now.
Yeah, they're protecting the environment as an act of freedom,
that's
which is
right.
a famous word in America. What are some of the films you think we've left out? I mean, it as I say, I love our listeners for picking things I never would have thought of and then telling me why it exactly fits. But what about the more obvious ones or other films that kind of come to mind that in some ways, you know, might have been tops of anybody else's list?
Well, I don't know if there, I mean, there's so many, of course, with any of our shows that we do that we could talk about that we don't get to. But one that was particularly memorable to me from a few years back, and actually one of the most devastating films I've ever seen, was a documentary called The Cove, which came out in 2009. And that is about Japanese hunting of dolphins and trapping of dolphins in this cove. And the filmmakers had to use covert and somewhat dangerous methods to film what happens to these dolphins. And we showed this at NC State, and I try not to sob in front of my students, but I was just tears rolling down my face. And they had a very strong campaign, which I think is always important for films that are going to devastate you like this. Like, what can you do? Because yeah. feeling bad about everything doesn't change anything. And so they had a very strong campaign, and I thought it was an extraordinarily important a document of what was happening.
And I saw a similar one screening for Full Frame this year about all of the sharks that are being killed for their fins. And the shark population worldwide is being devastated, and it's possible it might be in your cat food or something else, just not even labeled.
And that's part of what happens in The Cove, is it ends up actually in food in Japan.
Soylent Green.
My name is Jennifer Peterson. I'm a film historian, and I currently teach at Woodbury University. My current area of research is on media and the environment, so your topic is very much on my mind. And for my favorite movie about the environment, I choose Our Planet. What I like about this series is that it's the first time the BBC Natural History Unit directly addresses the issue of climate change. I've been a big fan of their previous series, like Blue Planet and Planet Earth, but they've always been kind of repressing the issue of climate change and human-caused environmental destruction. So this series is new because they make that the very topic of the series.
In the last 50 years, wildlife populations have, on average, declined by 60%. For the first time in human history, the stability of nature can no longer be taken for granted. But the natural world is resilient. Great riches still remain. And with our help, the planet can recover.
So to me, this series is important because it has the potential to spark political change and activism, or at least awareness of human-caused environmental destruction.
Jennifer talking about Our Planet series on Netflix.
It must be particularly heartbreaking for David Attenborough, who's certainly chronicled this for so long. But it's very important to make this a nonpartisan issue, because people of all political persuasions have to breathe the air and drink the water eat the food, share the planet with other species in order for us not to die ourselves.
And, you know, it's interesting. I haven't seen this series yet, Our Planet, but I just watched, and I will say it the way Attenborough does, Dynasties, also known as Dynasties in America, which was from the year prior, which follows the lives of 5 endangered animals over a long period of time, including emperor penguins and lions and tigers. And I think that that's kind of tiptoeing up to this point because they're talking about endangerment and how difficult it is to survive, but it's doing so by really somewhat anthropomorphizing these animals in terms of families and following them longitudinally. But it's interesting that the most recent series is just an out-and-out, like, this is what we're dealing with. But also, I like that idea of hope, that you're not just completely making people feel like there's nothing that can be done.
And when empathy, of course, is critical to all of this, and if we think about it, I mean, I'm wondering if you're seeing a trend toward things coming together. You've got the documentaries, which document in very clear visual ways and some good storytelling, we're in trouble, right? And then they tend to be dystopian sci-fi films, which really have to transport you to another world. And that makes empathy somewhat difficult. I mean, you get how dire it could be if we're eating people and scooping them up and all that sort of thing. But if you create an environment that just doesn't look like mine, a little harder to empathize. And I wonder if those two worlds are coming together, where you create a world that looks a heck of a lot like mine and demonstrate to me in kind of a sci-fi way just how horrible that all is.
Well, I think it's hard not to read headlines of newspapers and see things out of the movies and the documentaries that have been predicting and forecasting this for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, because every day there's new news about, ice caps and extinction and all of these things. And so, yeah, I mean, I think the convergence is our reality now. And it's just a matter of accepting it and dealing with it instead of wanting to dismiss it for self-interest for whatever reason.
On the State of Things today, we have been talking about your picks for films about nature and the environment. This edition of Movies on the Radio, Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State University. Laura Boys is film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art and also the curator of the Movie Divas series. Marcia's going to lead a Q&A after the screening of the film Kifaru,
yeah. So this is thematically tied to the show today. This is not until August, but it's August 27th, 6:30 p.m. at NC State, free and open to the public. You do have to reserve tickets online, but it's open to everyone. And this was directed by an NC State alum, David Hambridge, and it was at Full Frame this year and won a couple of awards. And it's really an extraordinary documentary about Sudan, who is the last male northern white rhino in existence in Kenya. But it's also about his caretakers. These extraordinary men who risk their lives and spend time away from their families to care for this animal and who have great love for him. And so
that's going to be Tuesday, August 27th, Kifaru, North Carolina State. We've got that information at our website. Laura Boys screening the film Ball of Fire at the Carolina Theater on July 10th and A League of Their Own on the 11th. All of that is at our website, stateofthings.org. If, as is true for me, you cannot get enough of these folks, go to our website and find out how you can see them live. The State of Things. Oh, what are we doing next? Next, the 80th anniversary of The Wizard of Oz.
It's true.
Next month. So that's what we'll be talking about. We're talking about The Wizard of Oz. So we want to hear from you as your stories about seeing The Wizard of Oz. You know, the usual way in, hashtag State of Things movie, right? And WUNC.org. And we're happy to take your picks. Stories about the movie The Wizard of Oz on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.